Okay, good morning. We ready, Jerry?
3 more years, 15 minutes.
People are moving football coaches around like
yeah.
Those things are so one-sided.
You better start generating.
I'm trying to be so one-sided for the coaches.
We need it.
Find myself in college.
Yeah. All right. I think we're ready.
25 years.
Okay. I call to order the meeting of the UTEMCO Board of Directors. The date is December 1st, 2016, and the time is now 9:39. The first item on the agenda for discussion and appropriate action is the minutes of the October 13th, 2016 meeting. Are there any comments or changes to the minutes? If not, may I have a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
Aye.
The minutes are approved. The next item on the agenda relates to the fiscal year 16 performance update. No action items here. Mark, would you please present our update in tab two?
Sure. Just quickly, these are all numbers you've all seen before. The only change here is we got the final private equity numbers, which we didn't have in October when we met. Those of you on the Regents have already seen this. So it just shows you our absolute and relative performance over the 1, 3, 5, 7, and 10-year periods. As you can see, maybe that first set of green numbers there, that's our outperformance relative to policy. And as you can see, over the 3, 5, 7, and 10-year period, that's ranged from about 100 to a little less than 200 basis points. So I kind of think of it as on average, we've added about 150 basis points over policy. We didn't do that in the most recent 1 year. We were basically flat to policy. And so that in itself is a little under what we've done historically. And obviously, we are very focused on value add. Again, this fiscal year, I know that's not the only thing that's important in the equation, but it is important. The one thing I'll say is for the, and many of you have heard me say this before, but I just kind of want to reemphasize it. The 7-year period, which is really obviously post-financial crisis, but also represents the period of time that most of the senior team here has been working together, we generated 8.4% on the Jeff and 8.3% on the Puff. And I think we all intuitively know that's above the 5% hurdle plus a decent long-term inflation assumption. So we were doing, I think what we should do at a minimum over the long term on an absolute basis. But what I thought was even more interesting was to talk about that 7 years in dollar terms, not percent terms. In dollar terms, we actually grew the endowments net of distributions by $4 billion. Okay? So let me make sure everybody understands that. $4 billion of growth ex distributions. That's on a nominal basis. If you assume we basically went and did the actual inflation calculation that was experienced during those years on a real basis, so including inflation, it was almost $1.8 billion. So the purchasing power of the endowments over the 7-year period grew by $1.8 billion net of all distributions. And so I always think it's important to talk not just percentages and not just theory, but actual dollars. So I want you all to take some comfort from the fact that over the last 7 years, the endowments have grown on a real basis, just based on the financial returns.
Okay, hold on. I'll ask this question. What was the contribution of West Texas Lands? It's X that.
The only thing it includes is the earnings off the West Texas contributions.
Okay.
So we dial out all distributions and inflows and only measure the growth of the NAV. The only contribution that we got from West Texas was the amount that
the
we
return
drew.
On that AUM. Oh,
yes.
Got it.
So all that's X'd out.
Okay. Any commentary from the board
what
on that?
What was the return on the AUM, plus or minus?
Well, so the returns ballpark during the period I'm talking about were 8.3%.
But in dollars.
In dollar terms. The return on that bit, I don't have that problem
I mean,
now.
$50 million.
I don't think
million.
It was that large. So you think in terms
nominal,
of...
Nominal, very small.
Well, so you think in terms of we're probably averaging during that period an inflow of, I'm guessing, around $700 million into the PUP from West Texas Lands. I think the peak, it was $1 billion, got down to about $500 million. So let's call it $700 million. 8% on $700 million is $50 million bucks a year. Something like that. Just total back of the envelope.
So that would have been $300-350 million of that.
Of earnings.
$1.8 billion you're talking about.
Right. And we can get you that. We can be happy to back that out precisely. But
I don't need the
point that. Is, this is X, all those inflows and outflows. It's just the growth of the NAV. And so, but what I would...
Important point. I mean, yeah, 7 years, net of all inflows, outflows, you grew...
The endowments by $1.8
billion. On a real basis.
On a real basis. That's exactly the point I made at the Regents meeting. Okay. And so, but the other point I made is the 5-, 3-, and 1-year period of trending below that. So we know that. So we can't have another few years of 2-, 3-, 4% or even negative returns because it will start to draw that long-term number below the distribution. So I think the important point is we have made what you've taken, we've replaced it, and we've grown the NAV. And so as fiduciaries, you should feel very good about that. Okay? The going forward story is what we're obviously focused on. So is that okay for everybody? Does that make sense?
You know, just one comment. I mean, June versus August. I mean, a huge uptick in performance.
The difference between, you know, I'd have to go back and reconcile with it. The only reason we report June is because so many of our peers report June. I mean, obviously the fiscal year is what's important to us. The difference is, I think, largely, I think markets came back both those months. And we obviously had some private equity markups. And so we can reconcile those numbers, too. I can't do it for you off the top of my head.
But am I reading this right? So period ending June 30, 2016, your actual return was negative 70 bips.
That's 1 year. So we're looking back 1 year out of June, and so there's 2 months that are different than 1 year out of August. And so if we had a negative returning month in that year that fell off, for example, it's going to change the math.
But then you were 400 bips of return.
Yes,
in
positive.
2 months later. Months.
Right.
The 1 month return for August was about 400 basis points. It was a large return for the month of August.
Boy, so you guys rallied strong in August.
Pretty month matters. Look, 1 day matters, right? I mean, things can move big in a day. So a lot of times it's also a negative month falling off in the trailing 1 year period. So we'll just, I can't reconcile that really.
Which it was, August 15, 2015 was a very difficult
month.
It was a
really bad market. Okay. Just anyway, it's such a huge delta between, anyway.
Even a pool as big as the endowments can move that much in a 1 or 2 month period, for sure.
Okay.
All
right.
Great. We're ready to move on.
I think that's me now. So the next item on the agenda is a report from the Risk Committee. There are no action items in this section. Kyle, please take us through your report.
Okay. In the Risk Committee, we really had three actions that we were discussing. One is discussion appropriate action related to the minutes. The second was discussion and appropriate action related to the categorization of new investment mandates. And three, review and discussion compliance reporting. And a couple of things had gone on with regard to issues that were brought up from the prior compliance meeting. One was there was a compliance breach that was reported by staff with regard to trading authorization. A trader had entered an order that was an unauthorized trader within UTIMCO. The trade was known by the CEO and the staff. It was noted by someone in staff. Compliance and Sissy's group indicated that she and her compliance staff has put new procedures in place to avoid any future breaches, and Sissy has delivered trading authorization and authorized trader forms to all of our counterparties to make sure and ensure this won't happen in the future. And another issue was brought up with regard to our investment grade fixed income portfolio, which now I'll turn over to Russ and his team to kind of talk about the issues that have been discussed and maybe a recommendation from staff on how we're thinking about this going forward. So, Russ, why don't I turn this over to you now?
This is all the hard copy 2 pages you just got.
Thank you very much, Kyle. Just a little background on the UTIMCO investment grade fixed income portfolio. If you'll look at the first page, the role of the IGFI portfolio and endowments are really threefold. It's a deflation hedge, and it provides diversifying power versus equity returns. It also provides high liquidity and then low volatility returns on a relative basis. The IGFI portfolio yield currently It was 2.39%, and it's averaged a little bit over 2.5% over the last year. It's consistently been a outperformer versus benchmark for 3, 5, and 7 years, and over the past 3 years, it's a top quartile performer versus comparable funds, according to Cambridge. The IGFI benchmark and the policy portfolio is the Barclays Global Aggregate. It's a well-known index, which is a diversified basket of global bonds, including 60.2% approximately of non-U.S. exposure. Now, Director Bass, pointed out to us that, which we knew already, but he made a point of this to us, and I think it's a very important point, that we do own bonds with a duration greater than 2 and a negative yield in their own currency in the amount of $173 million, which represents 4.4% of IGFI or 0.5% of the funds in total. However, when you hedge that back to U.S. dollars, which our partners have done actively and successfully over the years, those yields are positive and are competitive with U.S. Treasuries. Now, in order to address that concern of exposure to negative yielding securities, we'd propose the following guideline for our externally managed IGFI portfolios, and that's below. No non-derivative fixed income security shall be purchased whose yield to maturity is negative in its own currency unless the yield is positive on a U.S. dollar hedge basis. After all, what we do spend here is dollars.
So this was in response to a concern Kyle raised and just wanting to understand the risk in the investment-grade fixed income book. I think Kyle correctly identified the fact that we have some duration risk and some currency risk in the book. You know, it is a global benchmark that we're managing against, and 60% of that benchmark is ex-U.S. And so we have always been underweight relative to that benchmark. In other words, we've had more dollar securities than the benchmark does, but it is a global benchmark. And so we have bonds in other currencies.
What is our allocation U.S. versus the rest of the world in that fixed income portfolio? Since you're using a global benchmark, I'm curious.
Currently, it varies over time. As Mark mentioned, over time, Ray, we've been overweighted to U.S. and been overweight to EM. Versus the benchmark, which has put us in good stead. Our managers, our external managers in particular, since our internal book is all U.S., emphasize heavily real yields. They figure that value is going to come out in one or two ways if you look at a real yield. It's going to come out in getting rewarded through the bonds, or it's going to come out in reward versus the currency, whether it be versus the U.S. or maybe you're underweight the yen or you're underweight the euro.
And what's the turnover of the internal portfolio?
The turnover?
Yeah. Now, I mean, do you hold your bonds to maturity or not?
We do hold some to maturity, particularly in the spread sectors, where we find that they still have value, but it's not the same prerogative as we used to have when we were at an income fund, for example, where you were paying out that income. We're a total return fund, so when we see a better opportunity out in the market, we're going to take it. So our managers do as well. Sorry.
So Kyle, does this we wanted to get back to you promptly, as we said we would the other day in the risk committee, and we wanted to do it, to the committee. So does this address the concerns that you've raised?
So number one, thanks for coming to some sort of conclusion. It addresses one of the risks, but guys, what is functionally relevant here is in our IGFI portfolio, there are kind of two considerations we need to be thinking about here. One is a policy decision on kind of asset allocation to IGFI. We've had global interest rates go from the late 1970s to today from high double-digit numbers to zero and some below zero. And so one is a policy decision. The other is if we're going to allocate capital to IGFI, we need to think about the negative convexity risk within our fixed income portfolio. So one, this is kind of a subset that's being addressed where I found negative yielding German government bonds. And Russ, one of your answers is, well, we need real yields. You know, either we still have positive real yields in securities in which we own that might be zero to negative in nominal yield. But in the case of Germany, that falls flat, right? You have a negative yielding security and you have a negative real yield in the region. And we're hoping for currency gains. And yet this is supposed to be our safe money and our safe money with regard to kind of short duration investment grade fixed income. So when you look at the book, we have $400 million with nominal yield of bonds with nominal yields below 1%. And in fact, the actual yield as of the date of our analysis in early November was 0.13%. So we have $400 million worth of bonds that yield 0.13%. And the weighted average duration of that portfolio is 7 years. So tiny moves in rates are going to destroy us. So when you think about the considerations that I want the board to be focused on and the staff to be focused on are, we've had rates go from very high levels to zero. When we're thinking about the endowment in the next 3, 5, 10 years, and we owe our one client 5% real returns, why do we own something that has a nominal yield of 13 basis points and a duration of 7? And the answer I'm hearing is because we can maybe hedge the foreign currency back to dollars and be competitive with U.S. Treasury rates, but we still have an enormous duration risk. Okay, so we also have $800 million worth of bonds with a yield of 1.5% and a 6-year duration. Why not own 2-year treasuries that pay us 1.2%, 120 basis points, instead of $1 billion worth of things that have enormous negative convexity? So I realize that we benchmark ourselves, and I realize that we get paid in compensation versus benchmarks, but as a fiduciary and as a board, we need to have a sanity check, as Jeff puts it fairly often, with why do we own such crazy securities? So I hear Russ, I hear your answer about you say a non-derivative fixed income security shall be purchased whose yield to maturity is negative in its own currency unless the yield can be positive. But you don't mention anything about duration risk and real risk. When we allocate money to investment grade fixed income, we expect investment grade fixed income, lower duration, very liquid, right? This is the place for our safe money. It's not the place to put $1 billion in extremely negatively convex instruments and hope we make the money on currencies. So anyway, I am very opinionated here, and I think we need to pay a lot more attention to it. And Russ, I think you took one step towards what we're after here, but I think we need to take 3 or 4 more steps in thinking about the enormity of the negative convexity and what this means to the corpus over the next 10 years and how we think about which securities we own in your fiefdom and which securities we kind of refuse to own. So I'll work with you a little bit more on this, Russ. I just think your answer is falling flat with me.
Well, Kyle, if I could, I really appreciate when board members engage with us on, you know, any of these portfolio matters. You know, any of these portfolios, when you dig into them, they're complicated, and we make judgments on them all the time. And many of you are around the table, and you do the same in your daily businesses. I think on a factual basis, many of the things Kyle said were correct. What I would say is, again, historically, it's a top quartile portfolio. I think Russ understands his mandate very clearly. I understand we know well, Kyle, what we need to deliver to the client, and everything we do is focused around that. We believe that having a fixed income allocation makes a lot of sense in a diversified portfolio. We think we should. By the way, I think we are on a historic basis a little bit underweight our peers in how much fixed income they've had. I think we're roughly on par with them currently. I think Russ and Harlan do an excellent job of managing this. If we want to discuss whether we should have a dollar-only fixed income portfolio versus a global fixed income portfolio, I think we can have that discussion. What I do take some comfort in is we have excellent and talented partners who manage these risks for us. They have historically done a very good job. And so the empirical data is that despite some of the convexity and duration things that you pointed out, Kyle, that I believe are real, They manage those risks, a lot like our equity managers manage risks of 30 or 40 PE growth stocks. You know, one small move in earnings could destroy a high growth stock. You know, valuations are high. It's not dissimilar, I think, in market exposure and market risk. We take prudent risks. So, you know, I just want to be clear that we're not in any way unknowledgeable or unclear about these risks. And I think four or five reasonable people around a table could have a different view of those risks. So, again, we want to do our very best to address any issue any board member brings up on any portfolio, work with them as we have with Kyle. But I also think at some point you have to believe that that is what you're paying us to do, is make these judgments as we do with our partners. So Kyle will continue to address any concerns you have and work with you on this. I just want you to know that we believe we've been prudent, and we believe this response to your issue has been prudent.
Okay, Mark, I'll respond to that. Well, I appreciate your careful consideration. One would find it hard to believe that anyone would buy $400 million worth of bonds with a nominal yield of 13 basis points, okay? And I'd be willing to bet that anyone around the table with a duration of 7 years wouldn't buy those themselves. And so I hear a lot of things from you with regard to we're underweight our peers, we're talking about things versus a benchmark, and that you are saying we'll be considered, maybe we should consider buying U.S. dollar bonds. That's not what I'm saying, Mark. I'm saying that we shouldn't take enormous duration risk with low to negative yielding securities in our portfolio. Even if the benchmark is doing so, we should take a step back and say, maybe we shouldn't do that. Maybe that isn't a prudent risk. And I believe there are securities in our portfolio, a lot of them, that are imprudent risks. And we'll take this offline, but I think this is something that we need to be paying a lot of attention to, not just today, but for the next 10 years. I think Russ does a great job in managing his portfolio versus the benchmark. But that's not the question that I'm bringing up today. That's not the question we're debating.
Yeah. So, Kyle, all great points. I just maybe for another 2 or 3 minutes. Anyone else want to weigh in on this? Keith, Ray, any subject experts? I mean, Kyle's point is very well taken. 7 years of duration risk for 13 bips. I know I wouldn't buy those bonds in my own portfolio, and this is a in perpetuity portfolio. And so it seems a bit incongruent, but I understand the policy. So anyway, Keith, any comments, or Ray?
I just, 7 years is a long time,
right.
and the currency can go against you, and you can blow it.
I think
if I understand the point, California is a big number, so if you blow it, it can bring you down hard.
You bet. And the currency issue, I think, is secondary or tertiary, to be honest.
Yeah,
I mean,
it is.
That's fixable. I mean, I think Kyle's point is duration. And
I would ask you, Russ, is the allocation of what he's talking about right here, part of that reflective of the benchmark that you have to compete against? As opposed to an absolute return?
Certainly it is reflective of the benchmark. You know, the current benchmark yield, for comparison's sake, to the IGFI portfolio, as I said, as listed here, is 2.39. The benchmark yield, which is in a number of different currencies, always keep that in mind, is 1.313%. So we have a premium in yield versus the benchmark, but yes, it does reflect the benchmark. The one thing I would caution when we talk about duration and it being an unalloyed negative is that duration is your deflation protection. That's the only one you have. So you could put the money in cash, you could put the money in a lot of things, but if you don't have duration, you don't have deflation protection, and you don't have as much diversifying power versus equity. That's just, you know, that's just on a theoretical perspective. And, you know, with interest rates, yes, there's always the concern about interest rates rising. Interest rate risk is a risk that we take very seriously. Reinvestment risk, the risk that rates go down and you have lower returns, is also a risk. And we've seen that for the preponderance of the last 30 years.
Right.
And I'm sure when the economy turns down again at some point, we'll see that again.
Okay. So can I ask you also the duration of 7 years? Mm-hmm. Where does that stand in regards to historically where you've been?
The benchmark over the past several years, Ray, has extended somewhat, and a lot of that has to do with the fact that yields have gone down. You know, you're familiar with bond math, I'm sure. As coupons go lower for the same maturity bond, your duration extends some.
But are we?
So if you looked at the index over the past several years, the index has probably extended out a year and a half or so.
And it's, what, 6.5-ish, something in that range?
Yeah, 6.5 to 7.
Yeah.
So is it fair to say that our duration right now is the longest it's ever been?
The duration of the index is the longest it's ever been. I would not pass that through the portfolio necessarily, because some of our managers have shortened their duration. That's part of their tool set. So by comparison, we've been shorter than the index lately.
The only thing I was going to say.
Russ, can I add one more point here? Look, if you look towards the UTIMCO fiscal year 2017 investment policy recommendation that Ray, I actually don't know if Ray Nixon and Ray Rothrock have this. I don't know if they were here when this was distributed. But staff expects, when you look at this book, the staff gives their expectations for the next 10 years and the next 3 years of various asset classes of the endowment. The IGFI allocation, their expectations are 3.3% nominal for 10 years and 2.3% nominal for the next 3 years. Staff expects inflation to average 1.6 for the next 3 years and 2.4 for 10. So basically what we're saying is our expected real yield as per staff is saying it's going to be 70 basis points a year for the next 3 years and 90 basis points a year for the next 10 years on the IGFI book. So this is the policy consideration, but as a subset of policy, again, I keep focusing on the fact that we own negative yielding securities and almost zero yielding securities with huge durations. And it has nothing to do with benchmarking going forward. It has everything to do with just common sense as to what we should own.
Thank you. Thank you, Kyle. Keith, any final comments?
I guess I share Kyle's concern that 7 seems like a big number, you know, for the negative convexity argument being that rates don't have a whole lot further to go, so the benefit of that 7, you know, that risk exposure of 7 is limited, but the upside or the downside is considerable. But I was going to actually make Russ's point in that I think the board needs to think as you move forward into 18 and thinking about, 4-18, you know, the policy portfolio and what it looks like is what's the role of fixed income in the portfolio? And it's a lot more than just earning a return. It's, some of the great metrics that Uzi produces periodically show you that the marginal contribution to risk in the portfolio from the fixed income is virtually zero. And so it's a tremendous diversifier of risk across the board. And so you need to take, you know, multiple facets of this into account when you think about a policy. But I agree with Kyle completely that it's going to come down to a policy decision on where you want to be with the portfolio.
Yeah, and let me just address that. I have met with, I think now, 5 of you. I met with Ray last night. I met with Jeff originally maybe a month ago and walked through, and I met with Ray Nixon last week in Dallas, walked through this analysis of our performance relative to peers. And what I think we've seen is that, and I believe, is that almost all of our portfolios are performing really well. And again, a peer comparison is just one comparison. We understand the absolute imperative very clearly. It's the number one line item on the Chinese menu of what we need to accomplish is the absolute returns. But you asked a specific question at the end of the last board meeting about our peer returns. I've been going through that with each of you individually. And I think what has come out of that in my mind is a lot of clarity that I think where a lot of the focus needs to be is on the policy portfolio. And as I mentioned to Jeff in an email over the weekend, and I mentioned to Ray last night and a couple of you, I'm going to start working on the policy portfolio basically next Monday. And our intention is to come to you with a policy discussion starting in April, at least, where historically we have come to you in June or July. And so I intend to do a much more thorough job, a different job, I would say. I think I would say we've been thorough in the past, but we're going to engage with a lot of our partners. we're going to engage with folks that maybe you all can recommend to us to come up with a really thoughtful approach to policy for the next 10 years. Because whatever worked for the last 10 years is almost by definition not going to be the same thing that's going to work in the environment in the next 10 years. And so not only investment-grade fixed income, but all of our asset classes need to be really deeply thought about in light of inflation expectations, currency expectations, and then asset class expectations. And so I just want you all to take some comfort that I think we're going to be focusing our time, and I will definitely be focusing my time, on what I think is the single biggest contributor to our outcomes, and that is the mix or the policy portfolio. I think that's really where a lot of time and effort needs to be maybe more proportionately allocated this year.
And you are not going to go over those numbers today, correct?
No, okay. No. We're not. We haven't even begun. But my point is,
no. The numbers that you presented to a few of the board
members. No. I've been doing that in private to you individually, and so I've made it around to five of you. I'm going to get on Steve's calendar, and I need to catch up with Kyle and Mr. Adams.
Okay, it's a useful exercise, and while to be fair, the underperformance over the last 10 years. Has not all been attributable to policy. Okay. So
absolutely not
at all.
No.
In fact, I think half of the underperformance, if I recall, is value add, and half is policy. Over 10 years.
Actually, so you're talking
and
about
it depends
median.
Upon median versus right. 75th. I mean, I don't want to have an argument on how we benchmark ourselves at all today. But the fact is, I think we need to look into the policy. Kyle, your point is well taken. This is one component part of an overall arching policy that, for one, I'm very excited that we put some smart people around thoughtful consideration of what we look like going forward. So, Kyle, thank you for your observations.
Can I ask one practical question? Yes. Sorry, for Mark, maybe you can answer this. I haven't looked. Re-examine the derivatives policy in the context of a proposal like this, but it seems to like kind of up the ante on what that policy was designed for. Does that policy, the derivatives policy, give you sufficient flexibility to actually implement something like this?
Yes, it does. I think that's not an issue. You know,
so there are investment grade counterparties, for instance, that can deliver derivatives in every one of the currencies.
Yeah. If you it's not in this board book, but in past board books, you look at, we actually have, our counterparties have net exposure to us right now.
Okay. So that wouldn't have to be revisited at all?
I don't think so. Okay. It's a good question, but I don't think so.
Okay, great. Once again, thanks, Kyle, for bringing it to everyone's attention, and we've all got some work to do. Any other comments, questions?
I agree.
All right, great. The next item on the agenda is in tab 4. Kyle, is that the completion of your report? I apologize.
Yes, that completes the risk committee.
Great. Okay, thank you. The next item on the agenda is in tab 4 and is the report from the Audit and Ethics Committee. There's one action item in the section we will consider after Director Beck's report. Director Beck, will you please provide us with a report from the Audit and Ethics Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Audit and Ethics Committee met by way of telephone conference on November 17th. The members of the committee include Phil Adams, Steve Hicks, and myself, and all committee members were present at the meeting. At our meeting, the committee considered three action items. First, the minutes of the July 12th meeting were approved as drafted. Second, the Deloitte and Touche LLP audit results and communications were approved. And the committee also approved the audit reports of the funds, as well as the statement of investment performance statistics. The committee also approved the UT System Audit Office audit plan for fiscal year 2017. And then finally, the committee approved amended fiscal year 17 performance goals and made its recommendation to the Compensation Committee of the Performance Incentive Award for the Corporate Counsel and Chief Compliance Officer for the performance period ended August 31, 2016. Routine matters of the committee included a report from CISI on compliance matters for the quarter ended August 31, 2016, which included the quarterly compliance summary, the annual report on the institutional compliance program, an update on the fiscal year 16 action plan, and she also presented the fiscal year 17 action plan. Robert Cowley, who is the engagement partner from Deloitte & Touche, is available here to provide a report to this board regarding the fund's audit. Robert, will you briefly discuss the result of the audit with the directors?
Sure. Do you mind if I just take a seat over here? I never know where to sit, stand on this round table.
You can tell from his accent he's not from Texas.
South Texas. thank you, Mr. Beck. I'm Robert Cowley. I'm the audit partner that's responsible for the audits of the UTMCO funds. I've been doing the audit for the last few years. With me today is Aaron Dixon. He's the manager that's responsible for the audits with me, and was here for the whole of October, so it's, well, good to be back. If you look in your pack under tab 4, that's where our standard communication is. This letter is very similar to what you've seen in the past, and just not to bore you through all the detail, I will highlight some specific areas to you. At any point, if you have questions, don't hesitate to stop me, and or we can address questions afterwards, but feel free to ask any questions. Mm-hmm. So if you look under page 12 on page in tab 4, just to make confirm that we performed the audits for the Permanent University Fund, the General Endowment Fund, the Health Fund, the Long-Term Fund, and the Intermediate Fund. And we issued our reports on that on October 28th this year. Was clean opinions, no issues noted, so just to confirm that. If you turn over, I think it's very important to note that we opine on the results in the financial statements, the financial results and the disclosures. The audit was not designed to opine on the controls around financial reporting that you would see sometimes in public companies. That was not the scope of the audit. Probably the biggest change this year in the financial statements is the next item, was around the significant accounting policies. In the GASB world, it's called number 72, the fair valuation standard, that was adopted this year. All that did was bring the fund's financial statements in line, what you'd see in the normal public or private company world, in the FASB world. Probably the biggest change is there's this leveling table in the back of the report that's included. So that was probably the biggest change this year. But all that does is align the financial statements with what you'd see with other public companies and private funds. that did not impact the financial results of the funds. Unfortunately, it doesn't change the performance or anything, but it's just additional information in the funds. Around accounting estimates, the biggest area around estimates is the valuation of the private hedge funds and the private equity funds. From a valuation perspective, management uses what we call the practical expedient in valuing those funds, and all it is management get information from the underlying managers of the hedge funds and private equity funds and use that to value the funds. So that's the biggest area around estimates.
And are those, just question, sure. Good, are those private groups, are those audited results that they're receiving, or is it interim year results?
Okay. So the reality is, because of the year end of your term code, which is 831, I think there's not even one fund with an 831 year end. So they use generally the 1231 results. And that is being reconciled and updated and benchmarked to see if there's any, if the changes make sense.
So you rely completely on their judgment of the value of that private fund?
It's the judgment of the underlying managers, yeah. Still, like, I know that for a few funds, Mark and their team will make some adjustments if there was specific information that came, specific data that they can say, okay, now we need to go make some changes.
And do most of the private, are their marks all year-end, 12/31?
I would say 90% would be 12/31 marks. That is, but then the marks as of 8/31, the majority of that would be for the private funds. The hedge funds would be the 8/31 results reported by managers. For the private equity fund, the majority would be the 6/30 numbers reported. There's a few laggers, but the majority would be the 6/30 numbers reported.
This is an aside, but... and this may be heresy, but have we thought about a 12/31 fiscal year?
I look forward to the regents giving us direction.
I'll support that.
It would certainly make our lives tremendously simpler, but this is just part of the world we live in.
Fix the world we live in.
Well, I understand, but I mean, we are set up to operate to foot with the university's fiscal year for all the reporting reasons that they need. So our audited statements roll right into, I was at the Chancellor's staff meeting on Monday, Roger Wallace is just getting ready to finalize his audit, and our audit rolls into his.
I understand. So, but if we wanted maximum clarity, transparency, the best marks, benchmarks, et cetera, would a 12/31 fiscal year?
It would help for that reason. So, you know, a lot of our peers are 6/30. And so if you say, well, gosh, you know, the most important thing to me is know how we're doing versus peers, then 6/30 would be a better. So it really depends on what is your highest, what's the most important thing to you. In terms of closing the books around private investments, we get audited 12/31 okay. private equity.
Anyway,
about 90 days
that
after.
That sounds like a great project for you to work on.
I will add that to my list.
Pros and cons. 6/30, 8/31, 12/31. Pros and cons on each one of those.
Okay.
All right, sorry.
And the thing is, what's interesting about that, just if you, with a 12/31, if you want to move to a 12/31, that what I would to consider is, from a reporting perspective, a lot of the private equity funds' valuations or audits are only completed late March, April.
Yeah, it takes
April.
About 90 days.
So you're, if you want to wait for that to get absolute assurance, you're probably going to have to push your deadline back to June, to your reporting deadline to June, and the reports will only be issued in June, which is a 6-month lag. So I'm just, it's ever moving.
Anyway, worthwhile to, at least.
And Jeff, I'll add one more thing to that, right? The all of our quote peer comps, right? They're all what, June fiscal years, Mark? Is that right?
Most of them are, Kyle.
Yeah, I think there are only two in the top 20, Jeff, that aren't June fiscal years, and we're one of them. So it makes peer comparisons really difficult.
And obviously, they've been around the block several times, and so maybe they know something that we don't. So anyway, I mean,
yeah, we're happy to look into it.
Okay.
We used to be 6:30.
What?
We used to be 6:30.
We did, really. And who changed it?
How many years ago was that? 4 years ago?
I don't remember. Joan?
Well, that was just for the comp purposes.
Yeah,
we comp purposes. It wasn't the financial purposes. We would have to really go through the state of Texas and figure out how to handle that.
Yeah, part of the problem is the state's on a 831 fiscal year.
So the work would have to be done twice, essentially, because you'd do it for the December period, and then UT system would have to have it done for the 831 year and the rolling of the state of Texas.
Never simple. It's never simple. All right. I'm sorry.
No. Great question.
Okay.
Anything you can do for the 12/31, I'll support that.
Okay.
But moving the state of Texas is a big ask. Just to continue, just to confirm that as part of the audit, we did not identify any errors or disclosures of the financial statements that was passed by management. So, and in addition to that, there was no errors that we fixed as part of the audit. So there was nothing that we discovered as part of the audit that's of substance. next item, in the financial statements, as in the prior years, there are some other information in the annual reports. First, there is the MD&A. That's in all the reports. In addition to that, there's some supplemental schedules. In the PUF, there is a schedule that shows the role of the cost of investments and changes in investment income. And for all the other funds, there's a page on the financial highlights for the funds. I'm happy to report that we did not have any disagreements with management at all during the audit. Moving over to the next page, just to confirm again that there were no issues, no problems during the audit. We had the full support of management. I'd also like to use this opportunity to thank Joan and Gary and their team, because if you think about it, we issued the reports within 60 days after year-end, which is normally what you would do for a mutual fund. If you look at the complexity of this business, to close the books, allow us to come in, do the audit within 60 days and opine on that with no issues, I think that's a pretty amazing and impressive task. So thanks again, Joan. We can't issue it without your assistance and the work that you guys have done. So thank you.
Thank you for saying that, Robert. I agree with that. What our back office folks have to do to meet that 2-month deadline is a very, very heavy lift, and they do it promptly and they do it accurately every year. And we've come to rely on that, and I just can't thank them enough for their hard work.
As part of the audit, on the conclusion, we get a management representation letter. It's behind our report, and that's a letter where management confirms certain things to us. This letter is very consistent with what was there in the past. It's there for your reference, but we get that as we issue our report. And then, just to confirm, in our opinion, there's some other paragraphs. Now, most important, that this doesn't change the unqualified, it's clean. It's just some emphasis we want to highlight. The one is to say very clearly, like, these are the financial statements of the respective funds, and it's not for UT Systems as a whole. And then secondly, on PUF, we make it clear that it includes the results of the investments that's being managed by UTIMCO, and it does not include the 2.1 million acres of in West Texas. And we discussed that earlier today as well already. In addition, we also refer to the MD&A that's in the reports, and all we do with the MD&A is to make sure that that information is actually consistent with the financial statements, and we don't opine on that. So that's the highlights of what we discussed at the Ethics Committee and what I'd like to bring to your attention. But any other questions, I'm happy to answer it. 1231, I like that idea.
Mm-hmm. any comment on the materiality limits? 30, 16, 14, 15.
So just those materiality limits in the rep letter. What the purpose of that is just to set a lower threshold saying if there's anything wrong, we will report it and we'll bring it to your attention. So that's not the overall materiality that we use for the audit as a whole. That is just if we find something that we need to report, because there's going to be differences of $100 or $100,000, and then we're going to have this big laundry list of things that, taking the size and the complexity of the business, is going to be unnecessary noise and doesn't impact the overall reasonableness of the results.
I understand, but $30 million is not noise.
It's not noise, but it is a threshold that we use to come up with, because if you think 30 million on, and I forget now what Puff's now.
I know. Forget all the percentages, yeah. But just in absolute terms, I would ask you someone to look at this at some point, because the limits seem very high to me in terms of materiality. I mean, obviously, you're going to report a $25 million issue of malfeasance or irregularity, but I'm not sure that why they're so high and who set those.
We'll look in.
Okay, thanks.
We'll get back to you. Right.
Agreed.
Okay. I'd more like to say 3 million. Mm-hmm. But
just to give you an idea, just the number that was set by the state is 7 million. So that's a number that is set by the state, which is significantly lower than what what we would require and what the accounting firms generally require. But we can take that and come up with, if you want a different number, we can use that.
I mean, let's look at it. It's a big number. So lots of ins and outs. Yeah. So ticking in time. So. Okay. Let's see.
Mr. Chairman, there's a resolution in tab 4, and our committee recommends approval of that resolution.
Right. Okay. We need to approve the resolution related to the audit results and communications and the audited financial statements for the funds and the statement of investment performance statistics for fiscal year 2016. May I have a motion to approve the resolution?
I move the resolution, Mr. Chairman.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion carries. Thank you, Director Beck, for your any other comments on your report.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. All right. Next, we will go into executive session. Before we go into executive session, I need to read the following statement. The Board of Directors of the University of Texas Investment Management Company, having been duly convened in open session, notice of this meeting having been duly given, I hereby announce the convening of a closed meeting as an executive session to consider individual personal compensation matters, including report of compensation committee regarding performance incentive award for UTIMCO compensation program participants for the performance period ended August 31st, 2016, and the purchase, exchange, lease, or value of property pursuant to Texas Government Code Sections 551.074 and 551.072
respectively. The date is December 1st, 2016, and the time is now 10:27.